Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
I'd like to thank you for coming out to the Tattered Cover Bookstore and supporting your locally owned and independent businesses. I'm pleased to introduce this evening's guest speaker, author Phil Clay. Phil was a veteran of the U.S. Marine Corps, and his first work of fiction appeared in the Grant magazine in 2011, and it happened to carry the same name of this very book tonight, Redeployment. Since Granta, Phil's had work in New York Times, Newsweek, and multiple other publications. So he is here tonight to present this collection of short stories, his first. And I was reading the New York Times review, and there's a really nice bit in there that I liked quite a bit that says, "It is the best thing written so far on what the war did to people's souls." So if you would join me in welcoming our guest tonight, Phil Clay.
Thanks, everybody, for coming out. Thanks to the Tattered Cover for having me. When I told other writers who had gone on book tours that I was going to Denver, they're like, "Oh, you're going to love that bookstore." I was like, "Yeah, no, I love independent bookstores. I believe it." They're like, "No, you're going to love it." And yeah, I love it. It's pretty cool to be here. I guess I'll start with read a little bit from the first story called Redeployment. We shot dogs. Not by accident. We did it on purpose, and we called it Operation Scooby. I'm a dog person, so I thought about that a lot. First time was instinct. I hear O'Leary go, "Jesus," and there's a skinny, brown dog lapping up blood the same way he'd lap up water from a bowl. It wasn't American blood, but still, there's that dog, lapping it up. And that's the last straw, I guess, and then it's open season on dogs. At the time, you don't think about it. You're thinking about who's in that house, what's he armed with, how he's going to kill you, your buddies. You're going block by block, fighting with rifles good to 550 meters, and you're killing people at 5 in a concrete box. The thinking comes later, when they give you the time. See, it's not a straight shot back from war to the Jacksonville Mall. When our deployment was up, they put us on TQ, this logistics base out in the desert, let us decompress a bit. I'm not sure what they meant by that, decompress. We took it to mean jerk off a lot in the showers, smoke a lot of cigarettes and play a lot of cards, and then they took us to Kuwait and put us on a commercial airliner to go home. So, there you are. You've been in a no-shit war zone, and then you're sitting in a plush chair, looking up at a little nozzle shooting air conditioning, thinking, "What the fuck?" You've got a rifle between your knees, and so does everybody else. Some Marines got M9 pistols, but they take away your bayonets because you aren't allowed to have knives on an airplane. Even though you've showered, you all look grimy and lean. Everybody's hollow-eyed, and their camis are beat to shit. And you sit there, and you close your eyes, and you think. The problem is, your thoughts don't come out in any kind of straight order. You don't think, "Oh, I did A, then B, then C, then D." You try to think about home, and you're in the torture house. You see the body parts in the locker, and the retarded guy in a cage. He squawked like a chicken. His head was shrunk down to a coconut. It takes you a while to remember Doc saying they'd injected mercury into his skull. And then it still doesn't make any sense. You see the things you saw, the times you nearly died. The broken television and the Haji corpse. Eicholtz covered in blood. The lieutenant on the radio. You see the little girl, the photographs Curtis found in a desk. First had a beautiful Iraqi kid, maybe 7 or 8 years old, and bare feet in a pretty white dress like it's first communion. Next, she's in a red dress, high heels, heavy makeup. Next photo, same dress, but her face is smudged and she's holding a gun to her head. I tried to think of other things, like my wife, Cheryl. She's got pale skin and fine dark hairs on her arms. She's ashamed of them, but they're soft, delicate. But thinking of Cheryl made me feel guilty, and I think about Lance Corporal Hernandez, Corporal Smith, and Eicholtz, who were like brothers, Eicholtz and me. The two of us saved this Marine's life one time. A few weeks later, Eicholtz is climbing over a wall, and Sergeant pops out a window, shoots him in the back when he's halfway over. So I'm thinking about that, and I'm seeing the retard and the girl and the wall I Colts died on. But here's the thing. I'm thinking a lot, and I mean a lot, about those fucking dogs. So, it's from the first story. That was the first story that I wrote in this collection. I started writing it in 2008. A couple months after I got back from Iraq. Stories about an infantry marine who served in the Second Battle of Fallujah. And I'd known a guy who talked to me about seeing dogs eating corpses and then shooting them to try and stop them. And I guess that was sort of my way of thinking about the weirdness of it. So I'll skip ahead a little bit in the same story. And this is, you fly in and it takes you, you don't just kind of touch down and run out and see your families when you get back to America. You touch down in Cherry Point if you're a Legion Marine and you like load your stuff up on trucks and you go and there's all these kind of administrative stuff that you have to do. I had to get my blood drawn. That was like the first thing on coming home. And I'm the sort of person who like can't deal with needles. So that was fun. But the Marines are at the sort of the last stage. They're about to see their families and they're at the armory. When I got to the window and handed in my rifle, it brought me up short. That was the first time I'd been separated from it in months. I didn't know where to rest my hands. First, I put them in my pockets, and I took them out and crossed my arms. Then I just let them hang, useless, at my sides. After all the rifles were turned in, First Sergeant had us get into a parade formation. We had a fucking guidon waving out front, and we marched down A Street. When we got to the edge of the first barracks, people started cheering. I couldn't see them until we turned the corner, and then there they were. A big wall of people holding signs under a bunch of outdoor lights, and the lights were bright and pointed straight at us. So it was hard to look into the crowd and tell who was who. Off to the side, there were picnic tables and a Marine in Woodlands grilling hot dogs. And there was a bouncy castle. A fucking bouncy castle. We kept marching. A couple more Marines in Woodlands were holding the crowd back in a line, and we marched until we were straight alongside the crowd, and then First Sergeant called us to a halt. I saw some TV cameras. There were a lot of U.S. flags. The whole McManigan clan was up front, right in the middle, holding a banner that read, "Oorah, Private First Class Bradley McManigan. We are so proud." I scanned the crowd back and forth. I talked to Cheryl on the phone in Kuwait, not for very long, just, "Hey, I'm good, and yeah, within 48 hours, talk to the fro. He'll tell you when to be there." And she said she'd be there, but it was strange. On the phone, I hadn't heard her voice in a while. Then, I saw Eichholz's dad. He had a sign, too. It said, "Welcome back, heroes of Bravo Company." I looked right at him, and I remembered him from when we left, and I thought, that's Eichholz's dad. And that's when they released us, and they released the crowd, too. I was standing still, and the Marines around me, Curtis and O'Leary and McManigan and Craig and Weissert, they were rushing out to the crowd, and the crowd was coming forward. Eichholz's dad was coming forward. He was shaking the hand of every Marine he passed. I don't think a lot of guys recognized him, and I knew I should say something, but I didn't. I backed off. I looked around for my wife, and I saw my name on a sign, Sergeant Price, it said, but the rest was blocked by the crowd, and I couldn't see who was holding it. And then I was moving toward it, away from Eichholz's dad, who was hugging Curtis. And I saw the rest of the sign. It said, "Sergeant Price, now that you're home, you can do some chores. Here's your to-do list. Number one, me. Number two, repeat number one." And there, holding the sign, was Cheryl. She was wearing cami shorts and a tank top, even though it was cold. She must have worn them for me. She was skinnier than I remembered, more makeup, too. I was nervous and tired, and she looked a bit different, but it was her. All around us were families and big smiles and worn-out Marines. I walked up to her, and she saw me, and her face lit. No woman had smiled at me like that in a long time. I moved in and kissed her. I figured that was what I was supposed to do. But it had been too long, we were both too nervous, and felt like just lip on lip pushed together, I don't know. She pulled back and looked at me and put her hands on my shoulders and started to cry. She reached up and rubbed her eyes, and then she put her arms around me and pulled me into her. Her body was soft, and it fit into mine. All deployment I'd slept on, the ground or canvas cots. I'd worn body armor and kept a rifle slung across my body. I hadn't felt anything like her in 7 months. It was almost like I'd forgotten how she felt or never really known it. And now here was this new feeling that made everything else black and white fading before color. And she let me go, and I took her by the hand, and we got my gear and got out of there. So, I'll read something from another story. So there are 12 stories in the collection, and each one is from a different different viewpoint, a different perspective. There's it's from an infantryman. There's a story from the perspective of a chaplain, a story from the perspective of a psychological operations specialist, a comptroller. This one is about an artillery unit. So in Iraq, most of the artillery units, and guys find these big howitzers, big guns that can fire, miles and miles away. Most artillery units were doing infantry-type missions. But there were a few units doing actual artillery missions. And the artillery howitzers would be on a FOB, which is these huge, really secure bases, right? And, people talk about the FOB, it's like this kind of bizarre place because you're extremely safe aside from mortar attacks or whatever. And there are all kinds of amenities, and there's chow hall. This story set on Camp Fallujah. And when I was there, some Marine had recorded a song set to Hotel California. It's called the Hotel Camp Fallujah. And the chorus was something along the lines of, "Welcome to the Hotel Camp Fallujah. You're in a combat zone. Go get your ice cream cone." Which, I don't know, set it up. So, anyway, I'll start from the beginning. 10 clicks south. A click is a kilometer. This morning, our gun dropped about 270 pounds of ICM on a smuggler's checkpoint 10 clicks south of us. We took out a group of insurgents, and then we went to the Fallujah Chow Hall for lunch. I got fish and lima beans. I try to eat healthy. At the table, all 9 of us are smiling and laughing. I'm still jittery with nervous excitement over, and I keep grinning and wringing my hands, twisting my wedding band about my finger. I'm sitting next to Vorstadt, our number one guy in Jewett, who's on the ammo team with me and Bolander. Vorstadt's got a big plate of ravioli and Pop-Tarts. And before digging in, he looks up and down the table and says, "I can't believe we finally had an arty mission." Sanchez says, "It's about time we killed someone," and Sergeant Dietz laughs. Even I chuckle a little. We've been in Iraq 2 months, one of the few artillery units actually doing artillery, except so far we've only shot illumination missions. The grunts usually don't want to risk the collateral damage, so that some of the other guns in the battery had shot bad guys, but not us. Not until today. Today the whole damn battery fired, and we know we hit our target. The lieutenant told us. Jewett, who's been pretty quiet, asks, "How many insurgents do you think we killed?" "Platoon-size element," says Sergeant Dietz. "What?" says Bolander. He's a rat-faced professional cynic, and he starts laughing. "Platoon-size Sergeant AQI don't have platoons." "Why do you think we needed the whole damn battery?" says Sergeant Dietz, grunting out the words. "We didn't," says Bolander. "Each gun only fired 2 rounds. I figured they just wanted us all to have gun time on an actual target. Besides, even 1 round of ICM would be enough to take out a platoon in open desert. No way we needed the whole battery. But it was fun." Sergeant Dietz shakes his head slowly, heavy shoulders hunched over the table. "Platoon-sized element," he says again. "That's what it was. And 2 rounds of gun was what we needed to take it out." "But," says Jewett in a small voice, "I didn't mean the whole battery. I meant our gun. How many did our gun, just our gun, kill?" "How am I supposed to know?" says Sergeant Dietz. "Platoon size is like 40, I say. Figure 6 guns and you got 6.6 people per gun." "Yeah," says Bolander. "We killed exactly 6.6 people." Sanchez takes out a notebook and starts doing the math, scratching out the numbers in his mechanically precise handwriting. Divide it by 9 Marines on the gun, and you, personally, you've killed 0.7-something people today. That's like a torso and a head. Or maybe a torso and a leg. That's not funny, says Jewett. We definitely got more, says Sergeant Dietz. We're the best shots in the battery. Bolander snorts. We're just firing on the quadrant and deflection the FTC gives us, Sergeant. I mean, we're better shots, says Sergeant Dietz. Put a round down a rabbit hole at 18 miles. But even if we were on target, says Jewett. We were on target, says Dietz. Okay, Sergeant. We were on target. But the other guns, their rounds could have hit first. Maybe everybody was already dead. I could see that. The shrapnel thudding into shattered corpses, the force of it jerking the bodies, this way and that. Look, says Bolander. Even if the rounds hit first, it doesn't mean everybody was dead, necessarily. Maybe some insurgent had shrapnel in his chest, right? And he's like, Bolander sticks his tongue out and clutches his chest dramatically as if he's dying in an old black and white movie. Then our round comes down. Boom! Blows his fucking head off. He was dying already, but the cause of death would be blown the hell up, not shrapnel to the chest. Yeah, sure, says Jewett. I guess. But I don't feel like I killed anybody. I think I'd know if I killed somebody. Nah, says Sergeant Dietz, you wouldn't know. Not until you'd seen the bodies. The table quiets for a second. Sergeant Dietz shrugs. It's better this way. Doesn't it feel weird to you, says Jewett, after our first real mission to just be eating lunch? Sergeant Dietz scowls at him, then takes a big bite of his Salisbury steak and grins. Gotta eat, he says, with his mouth full of food. It feels good, Vorstadt says. We just killed some bad guys. Sanchez gives a quick nod. It is good. I don't think I killed anybody, says Jewett. Technically, I'm the one that pulled the lanyard, says Vorstadt. I fired the thing. You just loaded. Like I couldn't pull a lanyard, says Jewett. Yeah, but you didn't, says Vorstadt. Drop it, says Sergeant Dietz. It's a crew-serve weapon. It takes a crew. If we used a howitzer to kill somebody back in the States, I say, I wonder what crime they'd charge us with. Murder, says Sergeant Dietz. What, are you an idiot? Yeah, murder, sure, I say. But for each of us? In what degree? I mean, me and Bolander and Jewett loaded, right? If I loaded an M16 and handed it to Vorstadt and he shot somebody, I wouldn't say I'd killed anyone. It's a crew-served weapon, says Sergeant Dietz. Crew-served weapon. It's different. And I loaded, but we got the ammo from the ASP, I say. Shouldn't they be responsible too, the ASP Marines? Yeah, says Jewett. Why not the ASP? Why not the factory workers who made the ammo, says Sergeant Dietz, or the taxpayers who paid for it? You know why not? Because that's retarded. The lieutenant gave the order, I say. He'd get it in court, right? Oh, you believe that? You think officers would take the hit? Vorstadt laughs. How long you been in the military? Sergeant Dietz thumps his fist on the table. Listen to me. We're Gun 6. We're responsible for that gun. We just killed some bad guys. With our gun. All of us. And that's a good day's work. I still don't feel like I killed anybody, Sergeant, says Jewett. Sergeant Dietz lets out a long breath. It's quiet for a second, then he shakes his head and starts laughing. Yeah, well, all of us except you, he says.
Let's see, maybe do one more short section. This is a bit from a story called War Stories. And narrator was an engineer doing like route clearance and that kind of thing. And he's talking with a woman who was in the army, and she was a lioness. And so you'd have women who get attached to infantry units because to help like search the women to avoid, you know, offending cultural sensitivities. And so you'd have sometimes women who'd been in a lot more kind of combat situations than a guy like the narrator of this story. Anyway, they're discussing. Jesse taps her cigarette and a dusting of ash floats down to the ground. My dad was in Vietnam, she says. My granddad, Korea. But when my dad went in, he didn't think of the guys stuck in the frozen chosen after that asshole MacArthur thought it'd be a good idea to go rogue and poke China with a stick. My dad thought flag raising at Iwo Jima, D-Day and Audie Murphy. And when I went in, platoon in Full Metal Jacket, yeah, definitely not my dad in an admin shop. I bet more Marines have joined the Corps because of Full Metal Jacket than because of any fucking recruiting commercial, I said. And that's an anti-war film. Nothing's an anti-war film, I say. There's no such thing. Growing up, Jesse says, Sarah spent a lot of time at our house, and she still spends some holidays with us. Her family's a mess. And last Thanksgiving, we were talking with my grandpa about how nobody remembers Korea, and he said the only way to do it right wasn't to do a film about the war. Do a film about a kid growing up, about the girl he falls in love with and breaks his heart, and how he joins the army after World War II. Then he starts a family, and his first kid is born, and it teaches him what it means to value life and have something to live for and how to care for other people. And then Korea happens, and he's sent over there, and he's excited and scared, and he wonders if he'll be courageous, and he's kind of proud. And then in the last 60 seconds of the film, they put him in boats to go to Incheon, and he's shot in the water and drowns in 3 feet of surf, and the movie doesn't even give him a close-up. It just ends. That'd be a war film. Thank you. Sure. So the question is, why it was important to me to have so many voices. You know, I had a weird job in Iraq. I was a PAO, public affairs officer. And so I ended up spending a lot of time with a lot of different types of Marines. And, you know, doing everything from, you know, going out with National Guardsmen to meet with the Iraqi police and... or, you know, hang out with mortuary affairs Marines whose job is collecting the remains of fallen soldiers and sailors and Marines and preparing them to be sent back home. To sitting in on the battle update assessment briefs, went to the general. And, I mean, the range of experience is so wide. You could be doing the same mission. I've two friends, they're both named Matt. They both served in the exact same region of Iraq. They're both scout cavalry, doing the same mission. They both worked with the same translator, a guy named Suge Knight, or nicknamed Suge Knight. And yet, you know, one was there in 2006, one was there in 2008. Couldn't have had more different experiences. And I wanted to kind of break apart all these kind of things because it's so, I think when we talk about war, it's so abstract, right? And... and yet it's this insanely complicated range of situations that people have been put into and then the decisions that they've made and then the decisions that they've had to live with. And I wanted to have these different narratives. You could, I guess, kind of compare them against one another or, you know, think about them critically in that way instead of just kind of having a, you know, this is how it is war story. 'Cause there is no really, this is how it is. It just, it's just this wild and insane variety.
Can you talk a little bit about your writing process? Like, were you a writer before you went over there? Did you have ideas for the story?
Sure. So the question about the writing process. I started writing when I got out of the... when I got back from Iraq. And my, you know... I normally write by hand, and then I like will transfer the computer, not even really look at what I wrote because it's always terrible. I have a lot of readers that are really important to me. Folks that I met at did an MFA at Hunter. Folks that I met there are civilians, right? You know, one of my most most important readers, Lauren Holmes and Chris Robinson. They're both civilians. Lauren writes about like you know the sex lives of young 20-year-olds and these hilarious and brilliant kind of sad short stories, right, which are not really the same thing that I'm working on, but certainly had really vital perspective for me, right? And then also had a lot of veteran friends and readers, guys like Roy Scranton or Matt Gallagher, other writers. And so it was always just kind of this slow process of learning how blind I was, right? You know, you have an idea about something and you write it down, and then in order to make it breathe, you know, the characters kind of like rise up and they just take a pickaxe to all the ideas you had about anything. So yeah, it's just a slow, painful process of writing over and over and over again. It took me about 4 years to write the book.
what do you think of the role of a pastor in the service?
Okay, the role of a like the chaplain corps, right? Sure. I actually have one of the stories in the collection is told from the perspective of a chaplain, a Catholic chaplain. There's a really good documentary about chaplains called, I think, Chaplains Under Fire. It's interesting because, you know, when I talked to the filmmakers about it, and they were saying that, you know, the chaplain corps is both sort of has a complicated relationship with establishment of religion clause, right? Because in one way, it's the perfect expression of it. We, you know, chaplains from all different religions, in order to ensure that our troops have access to religious services. And of course, we're also paying chaplains to do this. I think they do really good work. I met good chaplains. I met bad chaplains. Most of the chaplains I met were really good. And, you know, some guys, I mean, look, the experiences that people have overseas, they're the sort of things that you need to talk to somebody about sometimes, right? And certainly, you know, some people, you know, didn't want to go to combat stress, but they talked to the chaplain. Or there's just, I think there's a way in which, you know, human beings need kind of rituals, kind of communal ways for us to experience intense things together. And you know, the religious services that chaplains provided, you know, allowed that for folks. I think it is really good. You know, there, you know, some chaplains are better than others, but most of the ones that I knew were actually, I thought, did a really good job. It's, you know, it's not an easy job, and yeah. Yeah.
Some of the stuff you said, like, in other chapters too, that seemed like you just nailed it, and it was also, like, something I would be afraid to say as a Marine, like,
yeah.
You know, like, Aaron Dirty Laundry or something. But I just wondered what, if you were scared to say some of the things you did, and if it's fiction, it's a little easier to get away with it, or I don't know.
Right. So the question is about, from a Marine, about, I guess talking about some of the uglier aspects of the things that people do in the Corps. I was definitely nervous. You know, I'd sort of like, I'd write something and then sort of think, well, nobody has to see it, right? So I can just be as brutal and honest as I possibly can. And that's the important thing, and working that out. And then later I'd be like, well, now I have a story that I think says something worth saying. I think, and I've actually gotten a very positive reaction from vets, and I didn't know how they'd feel because there's some rough things in the book. But I think especially, you know, because for our generation, we've come back and it's actually been a very warm reception, even though I think there's a civilian-military divide, and I think there's a sort of frustration about, you know, kind of apathy or lack of interest in the wars. You know, you'll get thank you for your service, and you see the support the troops bumper stickers and all that thing. And I think after enough of that, you go, okay, so let's talk about it for real. I remember walking down the street with a veteran, and he saw a support the troops bumper sticker, and he looks at me and goes, I support about 90% of the troops. There's like 10% who are total jerks, you know, like... but you know, you don't respect somebody by pretending that their experience was something that it wasn't, you know, or that, you know, they were, super hardcore master killer hero if they were just a guy doing a hard job, or gal doing a hard job. And, you know, and so I think that a lot of vets want people to talk about the, you know, the ugly side as well as the positive. At least, you know, it's the only way I knew how to do it is just, you know, try and be as honest as possible. And also, yeah, certainly writing fiction helped, right?
Sure. The question was about the civilian-military divide. It's very strange. During my 13 months in Iraq, you get 2 weeks leave, and I came right back to New York. I didn't have a very hard deployment, but, you know, I live near a trauma facility, and so you'd see people coming in, civilians, Marines, insurgents, Iraqi police, Iraqi army, just very horribly injured. And then I get a plane, I'm home, and 2 days later I'm walking down Madison Avenue thinking, like, this is not a country at war. It's just not. And then when I came back from Iraq for good, when I redeployed, that was less weird because I came back to Jacksonville, North Carolina, which is a Marine town right outside of Camp Lejeune. And there, we're at war, right? It's centered around the Marine Corps, and there's a very real sense that people are out there fighting and dying, and that, you know, things of huge importance are happening, and that we should be invested in that. But then I got out of the military, and I went back to New York, where I'm from, and I think most veterans who got out during these wars have felt this, because it's an all-volunteer population, so it's a very small percentage that serve. And they've been going over and over and over again. So I got out. I could have stayed in. I could have gone to Afghanistan. I could have done whatever, you know. But I got out. I'm living a good life in New York. It's great. I love the city. And there's very little sense of war. You don't really have to think about it if you don't want to. And yet I know people who are going over time and time and again. Sometimes very bad things are happening to them. And it's very difficult to wrap your head around, right? Especially because, you know, like we as citizens, we elect the leaders who send our troops to war. We as citizens are ones who are supposed to keep those elected leaders, hold them to account to make sure that, you know, we have clearly defined goals and that we're executing them and that we're, not sort of fighting war on autopilot as a country. And sometimes I worry that we're not doing that job, right? The war in Afghanistan just doesn't really make the news that much, right? It's not a voting issue really anymore for anybody, I don't think. And yet people are still dying overseas. That can't be good. Whether you're, you know, pro-war or anti-war, like, you want some engagement. And so I think that's very, it's a very weird space to be in, right? So the question is, do veterans want civilians to be involved in their return? I think they do. I think it's complicated, right? When you talk about the civilian-military divide, there's issues on the civilian side. There's also issues on the military side, right? You know, veterans can be very guarded about those experiences and sometimes very painful or very protective of what, you know, their kind of definition of what went on. And one of the things about engaging in a dialogue with somebody, assuming that a civilian has just as much ownership over these wars as you do, is you share your story with somebody and you don't get to determine how they interpret it, right? And I think that it's just... I mean, this is the way that it goes with anything difficult, right? You know, two people trying to communicate, the way that you achieve some kind of human connection is both sides continually forgiving each other for the idiocies that they say as they sort of slowly grope towards, you know, like a closer understanding of what's happening. And it's an awkward, it's a slow process, it's a painful process. But I think it's certainly something that can happen. I think that we are getting better
as a society. And I think that, you know, you're only going to see more kind of veterans speaking out and veteran voices in the conversation, as well as civilian voices, right? And I think that that's a good thing. You know, I think one of the best novels written about the Iraq War was by Ben Fountain, who's a, you know, he didn't serve, but God, that's a great book, and I think a really important addition to, you know, our thinking about what happened.
I was wondering, when I've always heard that writing is part of the healing process, mm-hmm. and something that's offered to the veterans, and your experience now being under the spotlight, so you have to read your book to people, and you have to take on all those other experiences that people have. I imagine they want to lean on you in some ways, and how do you feel about that? Is that still part of sort of healing process, or is that something that is, I don't know how to describe it?
So the question is whether, you know, writing is part of the was part of the healing process for me. I mean, I said I had a, you know, I didn't have a very rough deployment. It was, I think therapeutic writing can be very important for people, and certainly I know people for whom it's been very meaningful. I don't know whether it was therapeutic. I mean, you know, writing this book made me angry. It made me upset. It made, you know, made me a lot of things. I don't know. It was, I don't know if it was healing so much as, like, there were questions that I had in my head, or things that just troubled or confused me, or just that I had to figure out. And this is how I did it. Right. This is how I, you know, is how I worked at it. It's, you know, it is, and certainly it's kind of, particularly because I'm telling the stories of, you know, none of these Marines are me, right? You know, you want to be respectful of what people have gone through and understanding, right, with, you know, empathy, but also not, you know, not take any shortcuts, not represent anything in a way that it wasn't. So yeah, it's a strange thing. And then, you know, yeah, but it's good. I mean, it's what I wanted to do. So. Am I going to keep writing about the military experience? You know, I was joking with a friend, like, so we've done a panel, and like, you know, just talking about this can be, it's hard. And we were like, and I was like my next book, I'm writing about bunny rabbits. So I just get questions about bunny rabbits all day. I think if you, you know, you write about the things that are vital and important to you. I'm still writing, I'm working on a novel. We'll see how it goes. It'll be something distinctly different from this book. But yeah, I mean, I think you just sort of follow the things that are really, that you need to chase down and figure out in your own head, and work them out on the page with the help of a lot of friends. Thank you very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.